The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, M-E-E-audio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show. All right. I believe this means we are live, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions. Welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, some gadget guy, the SGG of this horribly, terribly named podcast series. Are my levels coming in a little low? I'm going to turn me up just a little bit more. My audio does seem kind of low, doesn't it? I'm gonna see if I can't boost, but I want to be careful not to go too crazy. Let me make sure I'm on the right mic. Yeah, all right. Turn me up before you go. LFA saying I'm good. Okay, my levels just looked a little off, so I'm gonna we'll see how this goes as we get through the podcast. I love diagnosing stream issues. We're doing it live. Folks, I hope you, well, first of all, thank you so much, those of you who are tuning in, because obviously, because of some arbitrary reason, we're all messing with time again. Time traveling an hour into the future, thanks to daylight savings time, an archaic tradition that has little practical relevance, but we're sticking to it because reasons, and it should have been abolished a long time ago. I have zero opinions on whether we should be on standard time or daylight time. I think we're just long past messing with clocks throughout the year. It makes no sense to me that we're still doing this. We don't live in an agrarian society. We need to pick a time and stick with it. And then just use that. I mean, we should all actually be on one universal clock. You know, if it's Greenwich Mean Time, that's the time, and not mess with stupid time zones. I'm so over this practice. But yeah, if you're catching this internationally and you're watching the live stream, then yes, it would appear that I am producing this an hour earlier than usual. But just so that we can all pretend and play this game that our silly, arbitrary measurements of time mean anything in any kind of cosmic sense, we had to spring ahead and set our clocks an hour ahead, lose an hour of sleep, and totally mess with my five-year-old's internal clock, because now she's just completely discombobulated. She went to bed silly early and then had to wake up. Like, this is madness. This is nonsense. So, I hope you had a lovely weekend, at least to take some of the sting off of daylight savings time. Yesterday was March 14th, which is also 314. Again, if you're in the United States and you put the month first, which was Pi Day, 314. So Marie and I, we drove out to a grocery store. We picked up a lovely Dutch apple pie, heated that up, sprayed some whipped cream on top of it. I shared a picture of that on the Instagrams. It was a lovely way to take the sting off of daylight savings time. We don't eat a lot of pie in this household. So it's always a fun treat when we get some pie. Nick Fell highlighting a couple of messages. Yes, embrace the nihilism. Nothing has meaning. I mean, in a universal or galactic sense. You know, at some point, we're all going to be approaching the heat death of the universe. So I feel like that's enough. That's enough evidence for me to say, hey, daylight savings time. Let's get rid of it. No point. An ER 1980 saying it's our turn in the UK on Sunday, the 28th of March, when we move to British summertime. Yeah, I just be done with it. Let's go, pick daylight savings time. I don't care. Stay an hour ahead. But this constant, you know, like throughout the year, flipping back and forth arbitrarily because some kind of weather, and that it doesn't really do what it's supposed to claim we're doing with, like, daylight and having more time. It messes with energy policy. It messes with internal clocks. We can kind of track loose correlating health trends, the increased stress, it's bad. It's bad for everybody. Heard it here. Oh, wow. We've got some subs coming in. Gary the Fireman gifting a sub to Vazicos 8. Thank you very much for that. Alt Dad Tech gifting subs to Gerald, Staren Darren, D-Word 1, O'Shea OK, and the Earthhawk. Thank you so much for supporting production. These streams, it's my favorite way to start the week, and I'm real glad that y'all are along for the ride. LFA Reviews has subbed again. Thank you very much. And I just got the little banner here, time limited. We have a limited time to earn exclusive emotes on the hype train. Woo, woo, riding the hype train. Already early. I mean, we're only a couple minutes into the stream. And Dave Burns, congratulations. Dave Burns paid off his car. All right, okay. So let's see here. We need to jump into some conversation. There's a debate happening on what the best way to note the date is. And I believe it's year, month, day. Like, that's how I categorize all of my projects. Like, it doesn't make any sense to put the month or day first on a video project when I'm trying to run archives. I need to know by year. So I always start with the year. I think that's the best way to do the date. I said I wasn't going to jump into this debate. And then I went and jumped into the debate. We have a ton of housekeeping. This podcast could be all housekeeping. There's some news and stuff. There are some things to talk about. I did so much last week, and you didn't even get to see a huge chunk of what I was working on last week, as I'm working with a major corporate organization to produce some content, and we're going through revisions right now. And still, even with that as like a major focus for my week last week, there's still so much more that we did. So let's start chewing through housekeeping. I'm not even going to play the game of how long do we think it'll take to get through housekeeping. This is going to take a bit. This is going to be a grip of housekeeping. All right, A number one. There it is. Galaxy S21 by the benchmarks, the performance plateau. Okay, so I started a review process on the Galaxy S21, just showing off some of my early testing. You know, I did a video on it. I actually put in the thumbnail, don't buy. This is probably the most critical I've been of any phone ever in an initial hands-on part of this discussion in the initial review. I am very anxious about the value proposition of the Galaxy S series this year. I think the Ultra makes a little bit more sense if you were looking at shopping near the high tier of the smartphone market. Stylus support is a big draw for me. So I feel like the Ultra makes a different kind of argument. But if you're looking at the Galaxy S21 base model, I'm struggling to see, or I'm struggling to define who I think this phone would be a good fit for over the savvy shopper who might be able to pick up a Galaxy S20 or maybe even a Galaxy S20 FE for cheap, and performance is pretty similar. I mean, like I said, in keeping with the tone of this, let me just kind of crack open. Oops, hate it when my web browser does that. Just real quick, opening some of this. This is my normal performance run. We start off with some Geekbench scores. Then we look at some video editing and rendering, complex projects, transcoding. I do a podcast mixdown. This is about the only section of the performance review where I feel like the S21 makes a clear argument over the S20. So, you know, to spoil my article here, if you are producing long-form interviews and audio podcasts on your phone, then the S21 is absolutely the better pick over the S20. Otherwise, performance is flaky, and we're seeing the phone come in kind of mid-pack against devices from last year. We're seeing gaming benchmarks and performance where if you game for more than 5 minutes, that your average frame rate starts to drop, and it's hard to keep up with phones from last year. On a game that I like to play, Undead Horde, the OnePlus 8T puts a hurt on the S21 over sustained gameplay, and the S21 is only about 8 to 10% better than the Razer Phone 2. The Razer Phone 2 using a Snapdragon 845, a much older chipset. So, you know, yeah, it sounds cool. Well, at least it was 10% better. That means like 3 frames per second on a game where 3 FPS is probably negligible. And Gary the Fireman dropping gift subs for Mr. Practical, iRiver APR, Salty, Only I'd Not In Use, and Lord Bia. So much appreciated. Again, thank you so much. And riding level 4 of the hype train right now. I appreciate the support on the stream. That's huge. Dave Burns, absolutely true. GPU performance will start to get harder to improve as we move forward unless we can rewrite physics. So here's part of the issue is when we're looking at something like the Galaxy S21, I'm anxious because I feel this generation of hardware, SoC, GPU performance, this hardware is really thirsty. If you follow a reviewer like Golden Reviewer, on his Mi 11 tests, the Xiaomi Mi 11, if you could sustain peak performance on this GPU, we're starting to talk about near laptop grade energy draw. You know, this is like an 8.5 watt GPU where a decent thin and light notebook might have a 25 watt CPU with a integrated graphics. That is insane power draw for a phone. And if I'm doing the math in my brain, if you could sustain 8.5 watt draw, you would nuke a phone battery in under 2 hours. First of all, we just know that the phone can't sustain peak power draw because it would melt itself internally. So this is precious territory for Samsung because I feel like this degrades one of the key differentiators left on the Galaxy S21. I get real nervous about things like DeX because I want people to be using their phones more, and I want them to discover the better general computing features. And DeX is such a crown jewel feature that I plug it into a Nex dock and I've got a computer that can rival Chromebooks. And miss me with, oh, but Chrome OS, who uses that? Because Chrome OS outsells Mac OS. So there is need for more computing, even if it's just browser-based, and Android has a phenomenal collection of apps for high productivity use. So this makes me twitchy. If you shop a used Galaxy S20, you could buy a phone at near the same price of an S21, even an S21 refurb or used. At near the same price, you're getting a phone that seems to have better sustained performance, similar camera performance, a higher or a more expensive manufacturing. It is a higher tier of manufacturing, build quality, the wrapped OLED, whether or not you prefer flat or curved screens. It still has the magnetic stripe for credit card payments. It still has expandable storage, which if you care about shooting content on your cameras, let me tell you, as I've been shooting my photo and video samples on the S21, I have had to dump footage once. That's not fun. I don't like that. All right, we received the level 3 hype train emote. So choo-choo, choo-choo. Right on, y'all. Thank you so much for supporting the production on this. I really do appreciate all of you that have been helping out on these hype trains, because like I said, I'm not real good at the twitches, and y'all are rocking my socks on this stuff. So it's pretty huge. So Galaxy S21 by the benchmarks, as far as I can tell, if someone can clue me in beyond gaming, I think I might be the only one who's trying to consistently perform real-world app tests. If there's anyone else you know as a reviewer, not doing speed runs where you just open an app and close an app and try and open and close as fast as you can. No. Golden Reviewer is doing an incredible job of testing gaming performance. Some of my friends like TK Bay have been testing gaming for a while. I don't know of anyone else who's really opening a real world app that you yourselves can download and install and run yourself and trying to compare performance generation over generation. I know, you know, the cranky nerds on our Android are going, oh, he cares about his video rendering, and that's not what average consumers do with their phones. And you can miss me with that. It's a real practical thing that you can do. And you can test it yourself. It's not a locked up benchmark of tiny little mini tests that this generation of processor seems to be able to accomplish very easily, but gives you no real insight on sustained performance and whether or not this is a practical improvement. Like I said, the only thing I can point to in this battery of tests is audio mixdown. So the only thing I think the S21 does better than the S20 is mixing a podcast. You're cutting audio for an interview. So if anyone can help me out, I'm putting out the call. We need to performance test phones like we do any other computing device. Like, imagine going to Gamers Nexus and seeing, well, I mean, we used Geekbench, and this is the pricing on all of these different products, and the Geekbench scores show you which one's the best. Okay, well, thank you for watching, and subscribe, and smash that bell icon, and buy our mouse pad. Like, they would be laughed out of the room, right? No self-respecting performance junkie would ever follow that kind of a conversation. And this stuff matters. You know, someone is buying the Galaxy S21 on the basis of Samsung marketing that this is a premier performance mobile computing platform. And if they're expecting to get more use out of it, I can't point to many situations where the S21 truly does unseat the performance of phones from last year. LFA reviews, where can I download the only Juan's app? Good Dave Burns. Why are average consumers buying $3,000 gaming rig? All I'm saying is I feel it's a disservice if we allow the sort of the performance discussion of the smartphone to be dominated by a usage that was accomplished 5 years ago. It's like we've defined smartphone use as being this like bare minimum. And it's interesting, especially tackling some of the conversations that I've had and international conversations where a phone might be someone's only modern or current computing device. And I feel it's increasingly important in this day and age, even in the United States or in North America, to point out where someone might be able to get more functionality out of their purchase price. If you're still kind of in that ballpark of phones are for social media and having a nice camera, spend less. Seriously. $400 or less, and you are well covered for all of that kind of use. Pick up a Pixel 4a, pick up a Nord N10, pick up a TCL. Do yourselves a favor. I mean, for my wife, she went from an LG G7 to a Pixel 4a 5G. We've got a podcast conversation on that. You can hear us mildly inebriated talking about her smartphone issues. For us, the challenge moving forward is every time we flip her phone, can we spend $100 less and keep her at the same compute power? Because she's good. She's not doing more with her phone. She shouldn't be spending more on a premium device. And the Pixel 4a 5G is nailing her level of compute needs. So that's exciting because she's not buying a top-tier Samsung or a top-tier LG to replace her formerly flagship LG. So, buy the benchmarks. I feel like I might be the only one. I would really appreciate it if folks listening to this or watching this can clue me in. If anyone else is doing more granular performance testing, I'd love to reach out to them. I've had conversations with the folks at Enantech. Their smartphone benching is almost exclusively synthetic benchmarks. I know Gary Explains has Speed Test G. That is a phenomenal resource for it being an independent metric and an independent platform. But I also have an issue with a collection of tests which are run in very short bursts to arrive at one number score. And for Gary, it's time. So even though I feel like Gary has a great handle on synthetic benchmark testing, his entire benchmark takes less time to run than one of my video rendering tests. So if you really use your phone and you want to splice a couple little video clips together and send that to your family, that is a different and a focused single-use application that takes longer to run than Speed Test G, running a bunch of little teeny mini tests. So again, I don't feel like that is completely instructive of what a real world use would be. Short burst of activity, switch to another app. Short burst of activity, switch to another app. Short burst of activity, switch to another app. And the test is completed in under 90 seconds. That's not how we use our phones. That's not how we might sign a document. That's not how we might edit a photo. That's not how we might, cut up a video. These things, it's a more sustained use. And then after you're done manipulating an image, then you've got to pop it out and render it. And so already the phone is working hard, and then you make it work even harder to get the final image. So I need some help. I would really love it if anyone were out there who could start corroborating or finding faults in my testing protocols. Like, thanks to Hardware Unboxed and Gamers Nexus and all of, Enantech and those top tier PC review sites, there are ways that you can compare and contrast different types of performance, different types of test rigs. There's more data. So you get a much better sense of, hey, does this Intel chipset really run this hot? Does this GPU really perform better for crypto mining? You've got more correlating and conflicting data to kind of maneuver through. Right now, if it's just me, that's a singular data point and a singular testing setup. So I need anyone else to care about this just a little bit more than, well, I ran a Geekbench and the score's gooder. That's dumb and I hate it. Let me sit up here. From Aditya, funnily enough, Mrs. Bagnell's mid-ranger will be up to date for longer than any $1,000 Android flagship. Oh, you're not opening Twitter and Instagram quick enough. Do you even performance test, bruh? And hey, Key, nice of you to join us. Nice of you to be here. All right. That was my cranky Samsung intro. I want to be less anxious about this generation of phones, but if it stands the way it is, like, I might keep my SIM card in a phone from 2020. Or I'm really hoping that phones like the Pixel follow-up maybe use the Snapdragon 870 with better optimization and better tuning. That could prove to be a better performance package. If we're talking price to performance and the expectations on really using a phone, again, it's making me anxious, and I want to see some other devices now to see if this is Samsung or if this is the SoC. All right. So let me go back into screen share here. Now, the happiest bit. So this Galaxy S21 by the benchmarks was one of my anxious and cranky bits. But the happiest bit of my week was the Rode Wireless Go 2 review. We kind of chatted these out a little bit last week. If you caught the podcast with TK, that was my best of the week for our podcast, best of our week. Those mics are phenomenal. I am so excited with what Rode has done for prosumer wireless recording. Tiny, discreet little transmitters and receivers, the ability to add a lavalier if you want to plug a mic into the casing, and the absolute best safety net feature I've ever used on any, even professional grade, wireless mics. So I'll save that the rest for the review. I really hope people catch that in this like creator space, and especially for sort of content creators. And then even if you just want to like spruce up a podcast or improve your home videos, or maybe you've got an elderly grandparent, you want to run like, you know, some conversations, like, you know, have like a family archive of memories that you can tap into. You know, there are so many opportunities. I really wish I had been able to chat with my grandfather more and save some of that audio. I never really thought about it before he had his stroke. You know, it would be really cool to just clip a mic on. Hey, Nana, so tell me, what was life like in the 50s? You know, how did you do this? What was school like? But, you know, there are so many of these rich, you know, moments that you should be able to capture. Having something like better audio is so huge. It's really a handy gadget. Sorry, I was just catching up with the live chat. Nick Fell with a highlighted message. I don't know when or if this will be relevant today, but I wonder why nobody's mentioned how amazing 120 hertz swipe typing is. It really is just next level god tier and completely justifies buying a phone for that feature, in my opinion. I've had to kind of reset my feelings on 120 hertz. I recently pulled out my Razer Phone 2 because I was just kind of using it as like a sort of, like I said, I used it as the as a comparison point against the S21 and how it's still holding up pretty decently against Samsung's latest and greatest. And, you know, funnily enough, I fired it up and there was a security update. So it got me up to the 2021 February security patch. And it's super sleek. It's so clean, the 120 hertz scrolling through menus and UI. But when I was really excited about 120 hertz, I thought it was going to be because we were going to get a bunch of games supporting higher refresh rates. And as we've seen, you know, gaming, it's pretty few and far between which games support over 60 hertz on Android. And I still think it's cool. You know, I even if I flick open a Pixel 5 and it's got a 90 hertz screen, it does feel a little smoother than a phone that only has 60 hertz. But I'm getting less and less excited about high refresh rate taking a bigger toll on the battery and not being utilized much beyond smoother scrolling and smoother UI. And not so much smoother that I think many people would notice. again, every single time I've gone to family and friends and I've put 120 hertz in their hands, none have been able to articulate any kind of substantive or practical difference between that and a phone that doesn't have high refresh rate. So I feel like the nerdcore fixation on faster refresh rate displays is misplaced, significantly misplaced, until we start to see where more apps and services can better leverage high refresh rate, and we can find a way to help offset some of the battery hit. It's still pretty common where I'll use an LG V60 heavy dual display, multitasking like crazy, and still easily be able to outpace the battery life on a phone with 120 hertz. That to me is a more tangible, immediate, and accessible benefit than just, but my app drawer is so sleek. It's tough. And there are other things too, where, like, you know, you can look at an Xperia 5 Mark II, where it does a simulated 240 with black frame insertion and has an incredibly fast polling rate on the display. And in gaming, that can kind of help. Like, that's snappy. It's precise. I don't know that I game that much better on an Xperia 5. Like, I feel I'm still doing pretty good, even in my twitchiest games, with a 60 hertz display. So it's not to take away anything. I just don't feel the people out there that are really making the biggest claims about high refresh, that it's you can never go back. Once you do 120 hertz, you just can't go back. I don't know. I kind of move back and forth, and I don't really feel it messes me up that much. I see the difference. I just don't know that I really care that much about the difference. So it's tough. Oh, and Nick is just backing it up. I suppose because I don't game on Android, I was never excited about that. I wasn't huge on 120 till I got the 5.2, but I swipe type everything and it's awesome. And the one thing I will point out on the Xperia 5 Mark II is dig into some of those game and performance settings, even just a little bit deeper. Because it does 120, and then it will also do 120 plus black frame insertion to simulate 240. And that screen, like when I do like slow motion video of like trying to compare different display tech, that screen is intense. And so you're also doing this on one of the phones that I think actually does support one of the fastest polling and the most responsive displays that's available. And it's not adaptive. It's just 120 or simulated 240 pegged. So I could totally see where that would definitely feel different and maybe feel a bit more noticeably different than a 60 hertz display for input or any kind of input lag. All right. Another video, another review that came out on the channel. There we go. In talking about tiny, adorable, cute little microphones, we also spent some time with a tiny, adorable, cute little PC. I spent some time with the Azul Byte 4. From Azul makes a lot of these like super small form factor, ultra low power, no cooling, no fans. I believe they're using the 4125 Celeron, the newer Celeron that just became a quad core. So we're not talking, you know, crazy powerful, gaming replacement mini PCs. They're a tier below like the Intel Nooks. I'm a fan of the Intel Nooks. I really like that project from Intel. So there's a lot about a tiny form factor PC that makes a ton of sense for business and corporate use. But increasingly, I'm still trying to find like...
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r glowing rectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
It's $250 for a Windows 10 machine that you can upgrade the RAM and you can upgrade the storage. You can pop in an M.2 or even a 2.5-inch SATA SSD. Excuse me. I'm still trying to find, like, is there something there that consumers can maybe latch onto a bit more? I don't know. I'm just so taken with these tiny footprint PCs and some of the flexibility, being able to, you know, kind of keep a low power PC behind your TV. Is that something that someone might benefit from? Like, maybe that's the largest screen in your home and you want to work on your spreadsheets from that. You know, I feel like there's just something there. Streaming sticks like the new Google, the new Chromecast, the NVIDIA Shield, those cover the bulk of the heavy lifting multimedia use in your living room phenomenally well. But I still feel like there's like that little gap. There's that little gap between streaming sticks and consoles and proper PCs where from time to time, I just need to use a PC on my TV. Now, for some people, maybe that just means plugging in a laptop. For other people, if it's something that pops up often, maybe you do want a tiny little low-power PC to kind of fill in that gap. Or maybe you're just home needs are super modest and you're just doing browser-based or document work, and something like this makes a ton of sense, and it's $250. So I really love spending time on these little mini PC builds. I really want to do more. Some people were like throwing out some other suggestions too, like maybe I need to be jumping more on Raspberry Pis. Maybe I need to check out, what was one of them? Was it the Lark? It was basically a similar guts to this Azul, but it's smaller than a Rubik's Cube. To me, small form factor is a very interesting and very specific kind of conversation, where you're balancing the overall physical footprint against thermals, against heat, and a different kind of conversation about processing power. So I think they're fun. Whether or not they always get a ton of traffic on YouTube is, of course, a bit more debatable. And then, like I said, this was a crazy busy week. So the biggie for best of our week, we had another guest on this week. We had Isa Rodriguez, Isa Does, and she came on to chat her experiences with the Oppo Find X3 Pro. TK Bay was, of course, flexing his ROG Phone 5. I was nerding out on audio because, like I said, I was really hyping up the Rode Wireless Go 2. Just a really lovely conversation. Unfortunately, Isa had some internet connectivity issues in like the first half hour. So, her stream is a little choppy at the beginning, but I promise it does get better if you want to catch the replay on that conversation. This last week, I also joined the crew on All About Android. The biggie sort of for the hardware block was talking about Nothing, the new company sort of. I don't know what it is that they're going to be focused on. It seems like they're going to start as an accessories brand, but a former OnePlus lineage. They were showing off some of their mock-ups for earbuds. So the name of the episode is Nothing's First Something. But they also brought me on to chat a little bit about some of the trends that I find concerning when it comes to ethics in tech reviewing, tech journalism, the relationship between manufacturers, YouTube influencers, and the communities that they all support. And I was really appreciative because I can get real soapboxy about that kind of stuff, but I really love hanging out with the All About Android crew. And so we got to have a conversation just kind of spreading out some of those different feels. And again, for Ron and I being sort of playful antagonists, you know, because his background actually isn't horribly dissimilar from some of the experiences that I've had in more media and content production. He comes from more of like an advertising and PR background. We've been on opposite sides of the line, but in very similar ways. So again, I like having that conversation, and I think it's something in terms of media literacy that it's the right time to be sort of reevaluating our relationships
with how all of these different companies do business, whether or not these trends are concerning or what we feel maybe some of these trends should be made a bit more unfashionable. McCorcoran 3 is saying we should bring on El Jefe and nerd out on some audio, which is an excellent recommendation, and he is absolutely on the list to join us for a future episode of Best of Our Week. We got to do some outreach. Also, we record a little late, so I've got to be a little careful. Like, we're trying to find international and West Coast contributors just to start, because we know we record our podcast pretty late. Speaking of podcasts that streamed a little late and that ran a little long, the channel Alt Dad Tech wanted to sort of discuss the question, is tech boring? And Alt Dad had me on to talk about that. And what resulted was another 2.5 hour podcast. I am nothing if not long-winded. But kind of digging into some of the frustrating aspects of tech commentary, I feel if you're watching a podcast like mine, you're probably inclined to agree that it gets frustrating. It gets frustrating when a preponderance of the tech landscape is focused on two or three companies, and then at the same time, you hear sort of tech commentators like, ugh, tech is just, you know, everything, it's a slab of glass. It's just sort of boring. It doesn't do what, I mean, what justifies the price? Is this a solution in search of a problem? And so you can't do anything fun. You can't take any risks. Anything that's more like experimental, or maybe it is, it's a bit of a gimmick, gets panned, gets trashed. It's not good enough. It's not worth it. Wait for generation 3. Better luck next time. Oh, but now this is dull. And how come we're only talking about Samsung and Apple? Mwah. And so I'm of course of a very different mind, where I feel tech has actually never been more exciting, and we're on the borders of some very disruptive elements. So I had a lovely conversation with Alt Dad Tech just to kind of chat that out. We're still not done with housekeeping, by the way. I got a couple more here just to wrap things up. On the Patreon over the weekend, we did another movie night where we streamed Spaceballs together. Really, I had a really good time just watching a silly screwball comedy. We're kind of refining how we're going to do the movie nights. And I thought this last one worked pretty well, but I still want to try and find maybe a unified platform or some way that we can better sync up, so it's not just push play. The tricky thing with movies is, we were talking like maybe there would be a way I could kind of host a stream and then maybe put it through Discord or something like that. Copyright gets weird. The audio got cut off. I mean, like it's tricky. It's so funny. Like, we think nothing of sharing a game stream on most platforms and having people on and collaborating and having these live conversations. Movies get weird. And again, it is technically, I think, not in keeping with Discord's terms of service. So it's tough. It's really tough to try and coordinate. But I still want to do something fun. Again, it's a community-based activity on patreon.com/somegadgetguy. And then in a couple of weeks, we're going to do another game night. So be on the lookout for another fun romp. Just kind of playing. I want to do some cards. Like if it's like a poker night or something like that, I want to do something fun. And wrapping up housekeeping, 9:40 in the AM. We still have one more to go. I wanted to highlight this. I've been doing some editorial work at reviews.org talking about broadband and infrastructure. And I cut this video. Do you qualify for the emergency broadband benefit? As we know, the FCC has allocated $3.2 billion to help people get connected or stay connected, you know, kind of help offset some of their or subsidize some of their broadband bills. And I wanted to highlight this because it's one of those things. If you're primed, if you've been watching my podcast for a while, you kind of understand my vibe on tech and politics. Whenever I take that show on the road, there's almost always pushback. You know, numerous comments. The reviews.org community is usually pretty chill, pretty like accepting. you mention a subsidy like this, and all of a sudden people are crawling out of the woodwork to, you got to get off the government teat, or, broadband is not a right. It's not for everybody. You got to pick yourself up by your bootstraps if you want something nice like broadband, you got to work for it. You can't just get things from the government. And it's very disheartening. Again, there's this odd gamed faux libertarian streak in the tech community that, I just can't handle the idea of us trying to reach out to underserved communities or trying to help people that aren't as well off. I see no conflict in this. Like, this is what I want my tax dollars going towards. I don't want my tax dollars going to tax breaks for billionaires. I want my tax dollars going to connecting people on Native American reservations. I want my tax dollars going to improving connectivity for underserved communities. I want my tax dollars going to schools so that kids don't need to do their homework in the parking lots of fast food restaurants just so they can get any kind of signal. I think that's BS for a country that's supposedly as wealthy and as prosperous as the United States of America. And $3.2 billion is a pittance in this day and age. I mean, but you want to talk about some outreach. A dude like Jeff Bezos could fund that 10 times over and still be, I believe, the second richest person on the planet. Like, it would not... It would barely qualify as a drop in his estimated valuation of wealth. And it would radically, radically change the landscape for millions of Americans on the ground. I mean, that's really how little money in the grand scheme of things we're talking, just to try and help people keep up in the 21st century. And that's sad to me that notion or that idea is, well, no, you can't do that because, like, you're not doing money in government. And government can't do anything. And you're like, shut up. From Aditya, did those commenters not live through 2020? Apparently, if in the middle of a global pandemic, you see a program for any type of outreach or help for someone who might need a little help, just staying connected to the internet, that person should just die. They shouldn't exist, and they shouldn't be able to benefit from any kind of program or stay relevant in the 21st century. It's their fault. It's their fault for, I don't know, not being good enough. If they were good enough, then they wouldn't have these issues, I guess. And no, I kind of disagree with that vibe. All right, so I think that finally caps us for housekeeping at 9:45. So in terms of the quantity of work that I did over the last week, that's about what I just talked through was about 2/3 of what I really did. I still shot ahead for future videos. Like I said, I'm working on a big collaborative project that I'm hoping, fingers crossed, we'll be able to start talking about a bit more, hopefully in about a week, maybe two. Last week was kind of the longest month of my life, and it was still some of the most exciting work I've done in a while. So I'm exhausted waking up on a Monday morning, especially thanks to daylight savings time. But I'm also really aggressively excited to start sharing a bit more with what's coming down the pipe. I'm really stoked about this. So all of the stories, all of the links, all of the housekeeping, the biggest block of links on the show notes this week will be the housekeeping. Because it really is all about me. I'm serious. I'd be Alt-Ed Tech, best of our week, that's 5. Last week's episode of the podcast, that's 7. I did roughly 22, I think 22 hours of talking last week to get projects done. That's a bit of talking. So I'm even just amazed that my voice is holding out today as well as it is. So let's jump into just a couple little news stories and see kind of where we end up. Yes, as I was mentioning, and I sidetracked myself again, I digressed. All of the stories, links, show notes, somegadgetguy.com. I want to start off with just this is a very brief follow-up and not something we need to spend a lot of time on, but this is one of those continuing stories. Like, I started talking about this a couple years back, and I find it very objectionable in the video game community that game mechanics don't factor into the ratings of video games. So if you go to the ESRB and you'll see, it's rated T for teen. Most of that is based on the story content, kind of like a movie. There are now notes that that a game might employ some kind of random chance element, or that real world monies are used for in-game currency, but it doesn't factor into the final game rating. So what I want to see is if a game really heavily leverages gambling mechanics for anything, even if it's not like, you know, real world money, but player progression is based on random events or random number generators, I want that to weight into the game's final rating. And I feel like as soon as you start employing some kind of gambling mechanic, it should be an adults only title. It just goes straight to AO. I don't have a problem with adults throwing money into this wood chipper, but that needs to be sort of the threshold. Again, it's a lot of work on parents and consumers to try and see what the landscape of this is. And I would prefer that the industry self-regulate instead of governments getting overly involved in the content of our video games. Same thing with movies, same thing with comics, same thing with music. I would prefer the industry self-affix a relevant grade or rating to that piece of media than having politicians decide what content can or can't be made. So when we check out just some of the news that's going on around the EU, Germany to potentially ban sales of games with loot boxes to minors. This is coming from Game World Observer. I don't know how to pronounce this name, Obedkov. Germany is considering a new reform of the Youth Protection Act. Government wants to protect kids from gambling-like mechanics by classifying games with loot boxes as 18+. This is about the most reasonable government interaction that I can envision. It makes me nervous because some type of regulatory board or some pocket committee of politicians will be the ones to determine what is or isn't a gambling mechanic. This is a wedge issue. This is a tip of the spear. If a politician wants to kind of make a name for themselves on a popular video game, get some easy big headlines out of the media, they might take a more aggressive stance on one game than another game. This is why I feel there needs to be an independent ratings board, and those ratings need to properly detail not just story content, but game mechanics and what might be appropriate for younger audiences. This to me is right up to the limit. Putting a regulatory action on this that says a loot box or a gambling mechanic means it's an 18 or older video game title is exactly what I want. I want it to come from the ESRB. I want it to come from the video game industry. I don't want it to come from differing governments around the world. I mean, we can look at some of the wacky policy in some countries where more adult-themed video games just can't be imported because only kids play video games and babies can't chew steak, so no one gets steak. You know, like, that kind of stuff is detrimental to the video game industry at large. But if we don't have a proper accounting from the video game industry detailing these game mechanics, then governments get involved. So again, this is like even more pressure to put on video game, the ratings board, to say, get ahead of this, or every local politician around the world who wants to make a name on hip new media is going to start getting in the way. Gary the Fireman, politicians manipulating the media? Say it ain't so. And McCorcoran 3, consumer advocacy in Europe is so much better than in the United States. I mean, just the fact that they're taking these issues as seriously as they are. We saw a handful of really some interesting conversations. I can't remember his name now. I believe it was a congressman, or no, was it a state senator out of Hawaii, really leading the charge on trying to get a bill through the Hawaiian state government to do similar things like ban loot boxes or fix different types of ratings. They held a committee hearing where members of the ESRB and video game publishers showed up. But this was like 3 years ago, maybe four. And we've seen very little traction on it since. I mean, just the general trends have kind of walked away from the old brute force loot box mechanic. But that's not to say that there aren't a ton of random events now that can cost people a lot of money. And McCorcoran 3, a young politician could make a big name for themselves if they went all out against the loot boxes. It's low-hanging fruit. I mean, it's easy. I mean, most of us agree. I hate those kinds of mechanics in my games. As soon as I start seeing, like, really heavy gotcha endgame, I'm out. I can't grind on video games is bad enough. I'm not going to sit here and toss in-game currencies into a wood chipper, fingers crossed that I might get some potential upgrade for a piece of armor. And it really burned me on games like Marvel Future Fight. That's a family-friendly franchise. It's for kids and for grown-ups, but with a heavy kid focus on a comic book property. And once you start getting into your tier three characters, it's nothing but like random number. You work for weeks to accrue this in-game material. You burn through it in a matter of minutes, and you still might not end up, upgrading the character with the kit that you want to get. And it's vomit inducing. I mean, those publishers, especially leveraging kid-friendly IP, they should be absolutely ashamed of themselves. And like, for me, that's enough where I want politicians to just ban them. Like, I get angry, but that's not really the outcome we should want. It's actually really bad in the long term. Following up on that last story where I was talking about the emergency broadband benefit, and also kind of back to that emergency broadband benefit, look at your circles of family and friends. Look at who might qualify for that. We broke that down in the reviews.org video. So there are some people out there who might be struggling a little and think, well, I'm not a low income household, so I probably don't benefit, but they might. And then it's just a little weight off their back. It could be a small kindness, a small assist, a small help. Just, share some of that info, because it's really tough getting good info on those kinds of programs out to the people who really would benefit from those kinds of programs. But on top of that, we also need to do a better job of just speeding up all of the internet here in the United States. We've talked about some of the recent initiatives, some of the chatter coming from the FCC. Last week, we talked about trying to reclassify what broadband was, because our rated classification for broadband is horrifically slow. I mean, we shouldn't be calling that broadband. It is not competitive in this day and age. So little murmurs, there are little glimpses, little things that could be exciting on the horizon. This is coming from Multi-Channel News. That's nexttv.com, written up by John Egerton. Representative James Clyburn reintroduces $100 billion Internet for All bill. Joined by Senator Amy Klobuchar out of Minnesota, House Majority Whip James Clyburn has reintroduced a bill to close the digital divide by connecting everyone to the Internet at high speeds. 1 gig is the goal. Quote, internet access will have the same dramatic impact on rural communities as the rural electrification efforts in the last century. This pandemic has further widened the digital divide and exposed the urgent need to enact the Accessible, Affordable Internet for All Act. So I am very excited about our politicians talking about broadband, talking about rolling out internet connectivity, trying to hook up more rural communities, and talking about some serious money to put behind these efforts. I think the critical concern for me has been a historical precedent where we gift major telecoms and ISPs sweetheart deals on zoning, access on telephone poles, tax breaks, tax shelters, low cost on using public lands to move infrastructure around. They get to charge fees that are still very difficult for the average consumer to untangle just what they're paying for on their bill. And then, I mean, last year, one of the parting gifts from Ajit Pai and the FCC was another, I think, $20 billion slush fund to improve rural connectivity when there is no scorecard. There is no way to validate that they really are holding up their end of the bargain. All at the same time that these major corporations like a Comcast can talk about their humongous, enormous profits, but we're not really seeing significant tangible benefits on the ground. And it seems to me that since we've started talking about rolling out fiber across the country, that we've poured hundreds of billions of dollars into the coffers of these mega corporations, and that we've seen very iterative growth on the ground. Especially in terms of duplex, like making sure that we can upload quickly is a practical use case, but we're still mostly focused on just the download speeds for how we consume content. So I am all for putting more public monies into improving infrastructure, but we need to, for the very first time, we need to actually have an accounting. We actually need to hold these companies to task. Dump another $100 billion into this infrastructure and then we don't see things improve, we want that money back. Or we get to take a greater stake of owning it as a public resource, removing some of the profitability from these mega corporations that aren't holding up their end. Infrastructure is difficult. Investment is tricky. But we have been pouring a lot of public money into this for a long time, and people are still woefully left behind where they shouldn't be, in major population centers and cities and in areas where it shouldn't be this difficult to improve broadband connectivity and broadband speeds. It's still this amazing challenge, and we've allowed too many states to write legislation against competition from self-funding municipal broadband or allowing other players to come into the space to shake up their broadband markets. So there are a lot of challenges here. The $100 billion is exciting. That's cool. That could really move us pretty far. To date, I believe we've contributed somewhere near $500 billion into our infrastructure on the promise of fiber to home. And most regions around the country do not have fiber to home. So I'm anxious whenever we start talking about big money for telecoms. And I don't hear what is the plan for making sure they actually deliver this time, because we've heard these promises before. We've heard about these initiatives before. Ajit Pai's FCC, I believe it was somewhere around $20 billion for rural broadband connectivity. I don't know that has gotten much better for people in underserved communities. So where are we at? Where'd that $20 billion go? I think we deserve to know. It's our taxpayers. It's our tax dollars. So it's something to keep our eye on as these stories unfold. Dave Burns, are you saying ISPs are pocketing the grants without actually improving their service? Yes. Dave Burns, I know that's shocking. Shocking, I tell you. Shocking. No, the only time service ever improves is when there's some kind of outside force of competition. If it's municipal broadband, suddenly these these Comcasts of the world start really aggressively pricing and going door to door and making sure people are on newer hardware and better modems. And if they've locked it up in a regional monopoly, there is no incentive to compete. And especially if you're in a more rural community, you are not profitable enough to get faster speeds. We talked about the elderly man who spent $10,000 on a Wall Street Journal quarter page ad to shame AT&T DSL in his neighborhood in North Hollywood. North Hollywood, California is a pretty population dense area. And there was a tiny pocket of fiber, I believe, three blocks away from him. And there was no way for AT&T to roll it out to his community because they just weren't profitable enough. I mean, stuff like that is just galling at this point. String the fiber, run the cables, hook people up, get the job done. If you can't, get out of the way and we'll find a company or we'll do it ourselves. This is getting silly at this point. All right. We do have one other quick news story. I'm actually doing pretty good on time. Like, I didn't want to make the news block too heavy here. This one I just thought was kind of interesting. We've been following up on our government's relationship with Chinese manufacturers. Who was it recently? So Huawei was on that, was on our entities list. ZTE was recently added, for telecommunications equipment by our FCC. I'm missing someone. There was another company that we just recently talked about. Excuse me. Sorry. I should have added that to my notes again this week. But one of the ones that I thought was kind of curious was, we talked about this a while back, was our government adding Xiaomi to a list of problematic corporations, claiming that Xiaomi was backed by the Chinese military in a way that conflicted with our securities here in the United States. I'm doing a terrible job of setting up what went down with Xiaomi.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Are you in the market for a new pair of headphones, Bluetooth speaker, or some true wireless earbuds? Then you've come to the right place. I'm here to help you make better audio purchasing decisions. From budget brands like Empow, Tautronix, to more well-known brands like Sony, Sennheiser, and AKG, I'm reviewing them all, including Soundcore and one more. My name is Jeff, also known as El Jefe Reviews all over the internet, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And I make tech reviews of audio products from a regular person's perspective. I answer the questions so you know what to buy, what works, and what doesn't. So before you make that purchase decision, make sure you check out one of my full reviews, and that way you get all the info you need to make a better decision with your money.
One of the problems I have with how we've been designating these companies as problematic is has been a lack of public evidence. If there is some kind of issue with Xiaomi products, and we can point to that being a clear security threat, for the people who use Xiaomi devices here in North America, I feel we should be able to find some evidence of that. When there have been problematic consumer devices in the past, we can see when they're sending data to servers that might be compromised, or they're utilizing apps or services that might harm consumer interests. I haven't found... Again, the high-grade United States government security threat manifested on Xiaomi devices. I think it's fair to say that some of Xiaomi's services can be a little iffy. Maybe use a different web browser if you're using a Xiaomi phone. But again, I feel like it should be easier to demonstrate a clear and present threat to American security. Well, Xiaomi took this ban to court. And it seems the courts are siding currently with Xiaomi. This this article was written up by Engadget by M. Moon. U.S. authorities added it to the list of Chinese military-owned companies in January. U.S. District Judge Rudolph Contreras has sided with Xiaomi in its lawsuit that challenged U.S. authorities' decision to put it on a list of companies allegedly backed by Chinese military. The Trump administration added the device maker to the list under the National Defense Authorization Act of 1999 back in January. It would have prevented American investors from buying Xiaomi shares and related securities starting next week and would have required all current investors to sell any shares they owned by November 11th. The initial injunction the federal judge has issued, however, temporarily blocks the ban. Xiaomi filed a legal complaint against the U.S. Defense and Treasury Departments a couple of weeks after it was added to the military list. It argued that the investment ban was unlawful and unconstitutional and something that would cause it irreparable harm, while also denying any connection to the Chinese military. According to Bloomberg, Contreras agreed with the manufacturer, calling the ban arbitrary and capricious in his ruling. He also said that the authorities' decision deprived the manufacturer of its due process rights and that Xiaomi is likely to win a full reversal. So again, I feel it should be easier to demonstrate in a court of law, if you're the United States government, why a company like Xiaomi would get banned. It seemed to me that Xiaomi products were probably being purchased and utilized by the Chinese military. Xiaomi has a really rich catalog of lifestyle, consumer, and photography communications equipment. It would make sense to me that, you know, if the Chinese military were looking to buy a crate full of drones for some kind of surveillance activities, they'd buy some Xiaomi drones. That is different than saying Xiaomi is owned and operated by the Chinese military to compromise the security of the United States. That's kind of like saying, well, you know, there are computers in our, you know, Justice Department or in our military that use Windows. So Microsoft must be owned by the United States military and represent a threat to every other country on the planet that uses Windows PCs. There's a lot of shades of gray in between, a shell manufacturer operated by a government that has some conflicting ideals with our government and a corporation that makes a product that is then purchased by their local government's military. So it's interesting to watch this play out. If Xiaomi is able to overturn this and win a full reversal, I think it might set some legal precedents just for future instances of Chinese corporations doing business in the United States, that we need to see a bit more evidence as to what some of these harms might be. I feel, you know, like some companies have been taken to task appropriately, like how ZTE handled communications infrastructure payments with unfriendly nations around the planet. So some of that made sense to me. Like, it made sense why we went after ZTE for some of those sales. Xiaomi kind of surprised me. I'm really not quite clear. I'm not sure what the big gotcha is supposed to be. And I feel that's a failing of our government, of our policy, and of our ability to communicate what risks or what threats there might be. Consumers should care about that. You're buying a product from a company. You want to know that it's safe to use. This is difficult. This is really hard to get that out, get the messaging out, but you get the big headline. Oh, Xiaomi's been added to the list. Fear, uncertainty, doubt. Now I'm very concerned about this manufacturer. Maybe I shouldn't buy any of their products. It makes it more difficult if, you know, Xiaomi tries to push smartphones in North America, you know, carrier deals. Look at how Huawei almost made it into AT&T and then just got kicked right back out of the market again. So we should definitely be keeping an eye on how this one plays out. Xiaomi is such a huge lifestyle brand. If there is some evidence, I hope we'll get it. I hope we'll hear where this might be problematic. But as of this moment right now, I can't say I've seen anything that would make me overly concerned about the entire corporation, the entire brand as a consumer electronics manufacturer. From Muppinish, I've switched the ROMs on all my Xiaomi devices. Still save money on the phone. Again, I mean, it's like, it's not to say that there haven't been some issues with Xiaomi. Again, we covered the Xiaomi web browser that would still track you in incognito mode. And they offered an update where you would have to go into settings to disable tracking in incognito. It still tracked you under normal conditions and sent all that data to a Xiaomi server. So I feel like that's fair. That's fair to highlight. But we just also recently saw a court case saying that Google was doing the same thing. So you know, all of these device IDs, I think it's hilarious. Well, Apple really cares about my privacy. Have you ever used Siri? Because Apple makes a lot of money making from Google, making sure that Siri can only use Google. And we're pretty sure that Google has been keeping tabs on people even when that traffic is supposed to be anonymized. So let's not be invested in one company's marketing on their privacy and security just yet. Let's see how this plays out. Simon says, Hypno, I'm just glad that Apple and Samsung aren't slurping our data. Samsung absolutely is. Thanks to one of the recent bills passed here in California, like if you've ever used Samsung Pay, all of that data was being sold off. They had to disclose it after California introduced a new law for consumer protections. The storage cleaner on Samsung might have been problematic. It might have been sending data off to another. I believe it was a Chinese plugin that came from a developer that was known for having some leaky consumer services. And Samsung came out with a press release saying, oh, no issues. We're good. And then just removed any mention of what technology they were using for storage cleaning in like their very next update. And like I said, you know, an iPhone might on its own be more secure until you use any services that connect to the web. and Apple can do a fair amount to try and mitigate some of that. But if you think you can browse anonymously or go incognito, I think it's pretty clear someone motivated enough to track you can hunt that info down if they want to. So again, it's more, I hate to say it, but it is really more like a consumer behavior, buyer beware kind of situation. Again, it's not Apple marketing at face value is accurate. What the iPhone does in terms of security and privacy, that is accurate. It's your behavior, which then compromises what the iPhone is technically capable of the second you sign in to any services that handle a web connection, might utilize some kind of Facebook architecture, might utilize some kind of Google architecture, or might utilize some kind of Amazon architecture. If you're staying locally connected to your Wi-Fi to only consume Apple products and services, you're probably fine. You're probably better off. That's not the reality of most people on a 21st century smartphone. So again, it's the advertising versus the real world consumer behavior. There's always going to be a disconnect there. Simon says, Hypno, I need a sarcastic emoji for the Apple and Samsung remark. And Muppinish, Linux phones for the win. I mean, again, Linux probably way better if you don't use anything else on the internet. I really need to play with what's the name of the brand? And they make an easy to repair, and also it's a Linux based device, and it's supposed to be all about consumer privacy. I can't remember. I've got it in my notes. I don't know. Pine. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Q3 Becker, Steve, Pinephone, and Muppinish backing me up right up there too. I really want to play with one of those this year. I've just been swamped. But that looks like such an interesting project. So that does this for the news block. We're only running a little over getting through housekeeping and the news. Just a quick shout out for the subreddit. We had another just really solid week, not just picking up new members. I think we're up 15 new followers on reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. This was also a really well-trafficked week just for finding some new creators. I mean, I say this every week, but this week, I was going through the subreddit going, I've never seen that channel before. I've never seen that channel before. And it's just, it's so exciting. The part of the mission, why I wanted to create this subreddit, I want to find new stuff. You know, it doesn't matter to me if a content creator only has 100 subs. If they're joining a conversation, if they're adding to a discussion, if they're making good content, I want to find them more than being served the same tentpole huge YouTuber channels out there. So some really exciting stuff on the subreddit this week. I think much to the chagrin of Matt Tyler. I don't know if Matt's in the live chat, but I did pretty well this week on other people's stuff. You're going to see this face on the subreddit hard this week. I'm feeling good because, like I said, this was a really busy week for me, and I really wasn't out there promoting as heavy as I usually do. A number one top, my appearance on Android, All About Android. Hey, 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 Ethics in Tech Reviews, Some Gadget Guy, catching the Twit Tech Podcast Network. I was so stoked to join All About Android to talk about this kind of stuff. Huge. Made it to the top. Reddit, our glowing rectangles. Number two, is tech boring? My conversation with Alt Dad Tech. So, you know, technically, the number one spot won by All About Android. The number two spot was won by Alt Dad Tech. But it's my face. Is my face at the top? Hey, hey, hey. Number three, piggybacking on these top posts, the best smartphone, why are you biased, from our Alt Dad Tech. Number four, last week's podcast did really strong. We were talking about the OnePlus 9, Hasselblad, the Red Magic 6, Snapdragon Sound. This last week's show was a huge show for this podcast. Then we've got Adam Reviews Tech talking about the iPhone 11 Pro Max. We've got Tech PhD looking at laptop coolers. We've got the Friday Checkout. This is the secondary channel for Tech Alter, talking about little phones maybe going away. We've got V60 in 2021 from Easy Computer Solutions. We've got my Galaxy S21 by the benchmarks. Josh Vergara, I am super jealous. I really wanted to play with one of these little Insta360 vlogging cameras. I think the combo of an Insta360 Go 2 and a Rode Wireless Go 2 would make for an incredible mobile production video audio setup. And these little cameras are ultra tiny. We've got my videos on the Azul and the Rode Wireless Go after that. Oppo Find X3 from Josh. We've got Skull Candy from Poetic Wiz. We've got Bored at Work looking at the ROG Phone 5. We've got Lisa from Mobile Tech Review looking at the Onyx Book Nova 3 Color e-Ink Reader. So that's about as niche as we can kind of get, but all kinds of just crazy stuff. iFi's HipDAC from El Jefe Reviews. We've got Kensley Innocent with 400 subscribers showing how to remove bloatware. We've got Tech Odyssey taking a look back at the BlackBerry 7100G. We've got camera comparisons. We've got TK Bay's Oppo Find X3 review. We've got the Oppo F19 Pro from Gadget Byte. I mean, this week was huge for the subreddit. There was just so much stuff to talk about. It was ginormous. So folks, my call to action every week, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. We're getting amazing submissions, amazing contributions. Don't be stingy with those upvotes. You drop a link, Click a couple up arrows on your way out. Help promote and help spread the word. Share this content with relevant subreddits. There's a little share that you can do to cross-post to another community. Make sure you follow their rules on another subreddit. But if there's some like-minded people, like, we get some good back and forth with the Sony Xperia subreddit, with the LG V60 subreddit. And I've seen a few cross posts back and forth with the Google Pixel subreddit. So there are communities out there where you can kind of help spread the word. I don't like to share on social media because I don't want to spam my friends. Then keep it on Reddit. But sharing, contributing, upvoting, and seeing some more comments this week was awesome. Just for really driving a broad conversation about tech, all of the cool things that folks are doing out there, and from channels like channels with a couple hundred subscribers up to channels with a couple hundred thousand subscribers. This was a solid week. I was really excited about this week. So reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. I hope you check it out. I hope you'll support, contribute, and I hope you'll get to sharing, because you know, this kind of stuff can really blow up someone's video and help them produce more cool content for you to consume. DTNL had a highlighted comment here. Juan is that dude who technically gets on the Billboard Top 10 simply because he rapped one verse for 25 seconds on different songs. Yeah, featuring. You abbreviate featuring to feat, and you've got some gadget guy right there ready to go. Now, I just want to highlight this. I did not get on the Billboard Top 10 because I was in for 25 seconds and a single verse. I did a 2-hour conversation with All About Android. I did a 2.5-hour conversation with Alt Dad Tech. I did another 2.5-hour conversation for Best of Our Week. I feel I'm earning these positions on the subreddit. I feel I am not only well represented, I feel like I put in that work, man. I made it work. Oh, I'm just kind of stretching. Okay. Paul Puri, feet, some gadget guy. McCore Corinth, those are really long verses. Oh, Muppinish, some influencer guy. I hate being an influencer. I don't like influencing people. I just like finding other nerds to talk to. All right. How do we feel about little phones? Because I am a really big fan of communicators. Right now, my SIM card is back in the Pixel 5 as I'm looking at trying to do a little bit of a follow-up, just kind of longer term, the most recent feature drop on the Pixel. And there's just something so charming about pulling a phone out of my pocket for such a good one-thumb use and navigation experience, where for so long of 2020, my V60 was the phone that had kept my SIM card the longest. I feel like we don't do a good job of fairly comparing different kinds of gadgets for different kinds of consumers. I think we do this way better with laptops. You know, I still need to send it back to him, but I've been kind of playing with it. And I want to do one last little kind of revisit video on the Panasonic ToughBook. No one is looking at a Panasonic ToughBook as like a casual average consumer computer, right? Like, that's not a thing. But we can look at, you know, creator laptops. We can look at gaming laptops. We can look at ultra portable thin and lights. We can look at modulars. We can look at slates, tablets, flip and fold screens, bendy hinges. We acknowledge that there are all of these different kinds of laptop. And that if you're trying to make a recommendation on one, it's not some global recommendation. Every consumer should use the same kind of laptop. So when I look at a little phone, an iPhone SE, a Pixel 4a, how much I desperately miss the Sony Xperia Compacts, a little Mighty Mouse phone is such a joy as a brief interaction communication device. If you're not the person who's streaming tons of video, playing a bunch of games, and you want something that's going to very casually fit into a shirt pocket, communicators are brilliant solutions. They're amazing. Quick at a glance. It's like a pocket smartwatch, right? I want more people to consider their behavior, and that might be the right fit for them. But we also have to acknowledge, just like I was talking, you know, back in the Galaxy S21 rant, if your main computer platform is a phone, there are very good reasons why you probably don't want to go with a communicator. It's silly, but I think a communicator actually becomes a bigger flex. If you've got a tiny little phone, you're kind of making the statement that you probably also have a laptop or a desktop or some other better, more premium workspace to get stuff done, and you probably have other complementing computers. You know, there's almost a luxury quality to a good communicator phone that sends out a message beyond, like, you just spent the most on, like, the biggest, you know, iPhone Max. I've got the iPhone 12 mini. That's how important I am. I have other people to scurry around and do my work for me. But we got this article coming back. I'm sorry, that was all a really rambling way to say a communicator phone is its own niche. A gaming phone, we understand, is a niche product. An Xperia 1 is a photography-focused content creation platform. That's its own niche. An LG V60 with a dual display case is a very specific niche of multitasking and productivity. A Galaxy Note, a Galaxy Fold. These occupy a sliver of the segment. None of those are broad mass market devices. They're not. They deserve to be discussed for a particular community who might find those features a benefit. Communicator phone is its own slice, is its own niche. So I get kind of cranky when we overly weight a part of our gadget commentary to say, like, oh, Apple's cutting back on the iPhone 12 mini. I guess tiny phones are dead, which I don't think could be farther from the truth. So this was written up by Nikkei Asia. I don't know how to pronounce that. Apple slashes planned iPhone 12 mini production for the first half of 2021. The U.S. tech giant. See, this is what's frustrating. The U.S. tech giant is cutting orders for all iPhones by around 20% compared to its plans in December, according to sources familiar with the matter, with the majority coming from the Mini, its cheapest 5G-enabled phone. Late last year, Apple told suppliers to secure components and parts for up to 96 million handsets, including the entire iPhone 12 series, for the first 6 months of 2021. The total also included older iPhone 11 and the iPhone SE models. Excuse me. At one point, Apple even told some suppliers that it needed components for more than 100 million phones for the first half of the year in a bid to secure components and production capacity amid global shortages. The company is now targeting production of around 75 million units, slightly higher than iPhone shipments in the same period last year. The company told suppliers that it still intends to build 230 million iPhones for 2021, an increase of more than 11% from last year, sources said. The biggest revision is for components and parts for the 5.4-inch iPhone 12 mini. Some suppliers were even asked to temporarily stop building components, especially for the mini. The mildest estimate was that Apple will cut planned production by more than 70% for the 6 months through June. Okay, that's a different story than tiny phones are dead. The iPhone 12 mini has a tough case to make. I have the second generation iPhone SE. If you're looking for a communicator, you don't care about the highest end horsepower. What are you doing on a tiny screen that you need the guts of a hardcore premium tier productivity or gaming phone? Because you don't really play games on the tiniest screen. You're not really sitting and consuming a ton of video content on the smallest screen. You've got the smallest form factor with the smallest battery. You might not even be able to put on additional camera sensors on a tiny communicator phone. That's not what those phones are about. So the iPhone 12 mini is a tough call. If 5G is not a critical ask in your area, like you're not really concerned about, you know, 5G over the next 2 years, which I think is fair in a number of regions around the world, your outlook for sub six might still be 2023. Well, if that's the case, you could pick up a much less expensive iPhone SE. I think it's still a benefit having Touch ID. I still greatly prefer Touch ID over Face Unlock. And you've got a wealth of accessories to choose from. It's compatible with all of the cases and mounts and clips and stands and adapters and camera, you know, lenses. Everything from the iPhone 8 is compatible with the iPhone SE. It's a no-brainer to me. You go with the cheaper phone that's going to do everything pretty much about as good as the iPhone 12 mini, and you call it a day, and you're fine. Repair parts are going to be easier to source, you know, displays, the camera can be swapped out almost one for one. The logic board is nearly the same. I mean, like the iPhone 8 is so well understood by the market and by consumers. Why change? Again, my wife has an iPhone 8 for work. Her work phone issued by her company is an iPhone 8, and they're trying to get her to upgrade. And she's seriously asking them, can you just swap it out for an iPhone SE? I don't want to change anything about this phone. I want it to be the same and basically just have like a new battery in there again. And she's fine. Like she'll be covered. So the iPhone 12 mini has a tough challenge in just unseating its own internal competition with the iPhone SE. It's not to say that the iPhone 12 mini is a failure. It's not to say that I think Apple's going to get rid of that product segment. I think it's just on Apple now to do a better job of delineating what the benefits are. I think Apple's starting to put out too many phones. You've got two flavors of the Pro, you've got two flavors of the mainstream and an iPhone SE, and you're still carrying the older phones from the year before. At any given point, there are 2, 4, 5, 6, 7. There are maybe as many as 9 flavors of iPhone in active retail just from Apple, let alone from carriers that are also trying to still offload like iPhone XRs. So that's tough. That's a tricky market where I don't think Apple actually does a good job of treading that trail. I don't think they've trained their audience to understand all of the different segments, permutations, and the pricing differences between different generations of phones, different sizes of phones, and then different tiers of phones. Like it's been a challenge for OnePlus adding more phones to their lineup. I think Apple's customer base has actually been better trained to expect this is iPhone. And now they're being asked to understand here's 7 different flavors of iPhone. That's a hard conversation. So Apple cutting these orders, I get it. You know, but to write your editorial or to comment on the market where Apple's entire iPhone outlook is being reduced from their expectations at the end of the year. The iPhone 12 mini is a larger part of that focus, but every model of iPhone is being pulled back in manufacturing. Every single version, not just the mini. I think it's, again, I hate how we kind of build these messaging trends off of a very lazy or shallow truism. Oh, Apple's cutting back orders on the iPhone 12 mini. Mini phones are dead. No one buys them. You are bad at tech if you buy mini phone. It's not how this works. That's a bad editorial. That's a cheap, low-hanging fruit FUD editorial.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
McCorcoran 3. A lot of normal users just go to the Apple website and buy the least expensive phone. Right now, that's the SE. The only iPhone I'm running in-house right now is the iPhone SE. I don't like Face Unlock. I don't like the notch that cuts into content on the screen. I hate that Apple won't make that a buffer. So it won't pad the display margins in apps so that when you go full screen in a game or an app, the notch doesn't cut into the display. I think that's so dumb. It's been a challenge on Android, but at least some phones will kind of pad the notification bar so that you don't have a disruption in your content. The iPhone SE is a brilliant one thumb device. The battery life is meager, but if you're really honest about your needs and you're a short form burst of short, quick, interactions kind of person, I think it's silly, to spend a lot more on a phone if you're not really taking advantage of extra features and extra bells and extra whistles. Pixel 4a, iPhone SE, they're monster phones with very few compromises for that consumer who's at a glance and back on with their day. It's beautiful. Those things work so well. From Dave Burns, I kind of wish that Apple would make a second processor for their phones that are built for low power consumption, unless iOS has gotten so bloated it needs an A14 to run well. The way that Apple ties in graphics processing and managing their UI, I don't think you can go too lean, but I totally agree. Like, imagine a lower tier A series processor just built on a current fabrication process. Because I'll tell you, I still occasionally trot out my original 16 gigabyte iPhone SE. The first launch generation, I did get the battery replaced after the battery throttling lawsuit. That phone is so good. It's so tiny. It still shoots 4K video. I mean, you can't shoot a lot of it because I don't have a lot of storage. It's phenomenal. It's the best Mighty Mouse phone ever. When I travel, I like having a phone that is just like bare minimum one thumb. I can do everything on it while hauling a suitcase and luggage and trying to keep track of my daughter. I mean, like, when we're back on airplanes again, I'm probably gonna reactivate the original iPhone SE as my weekender or travel companion phone. It's brilliant. It's such a good phone. And just, you miss some of that if we make this discussion on different kinds of phones too broad. You know, if we just make it like, oh, well, more people buy bigger phones, I guess, but not all bigger phones are the same. You know, you can have a bigger phone that's just good for video. You can have a bigger phone that's great for gaming. I mean, like, stop trying to say that screen size is this one thing for all consumers, because that's not the case. And ER1980, this is a great point. Pricing is key. The $399 iPhone SE 2 is going to outsell the iPhone 12 mini that costs twice the amount for those that want a small phone. I also agree Apple has flooded the market with too many phones, and resale value of iPhones has dropped as a result too. Well, and I also feel like the resale market is getting hammered by like trade-in deals. The traditional used market is definitely getting disrupted by certain companies that are looking to kind of manipulate consumer behavior. F. Mooney's telling me to hydrate and Paul is telling me to stretch, and I'm going to do both. From Squishyman 2007, I know the iPhone 6 is old and it's on iOS 12, but it still works well for what I want, and thus the SE 2 isn't quite worth the upgrade, even though it's relatively cheap. iPhone 6. If you've got an iPhone 6 in operation, that's pretty good, because those phones were a little fragile for flex damage. I don't find any fault with that. The nice thing about the SE, the original SE, was that it did get the processor bump of the iPhone 6S. It got the camera of the iPhone 6S, and it kept the headphone jack. And after that point, I kind of feel iPhones go downhill. The iPhones become less interesting to me when Apple started doing things like getting rid of the headphone jack, because I'm old and cranky. All right. I want to kind of close out part of this conversation, part of this podcast. Are we seeing a little glimmer of hope for Wear OS? Is there just the tiniest little heartbeat left on Google's wearable strategy? It has been so interesting to see. Samsung is rumored to be putting out a Galaxy Watch running Wear OS. Mobvoi, they just announced a revised version of the TicWatch 3 Pro. What are they calling? I think they're calling it the TicWatch S or the TicWatch Pro S or something like that. Almost exactly the same as the TicWatch 3 Pro that I'm wearing right now, but it's improving on the water resistance. This watch that I'm wearing, not the watch you want to wear if you're a swimmer. And so they're building a specific variant for better ingress protection, better IP certifications, and with the express purpose of being a companion for more aquatic activities. Now we're hearing OnePlus is likely going to be talking about something on March 23rd. This is written up by R. Lawler at Engadget. Reveal its first smartwatch on March 23rd. As we expect from OnePlus at this point, the march to a new product release includes a steady drip feed of information that includes its first watch, which we will see on March 23rd at the same time its new OnePlus 9 series of phone launches. And they had like a little teaser video. I have my volume down. Just want to make sure I don't blast anyone's hearing here. Oh, no, that didn't take me to the little video clip at all. That didn't help. Come on, Engadget. You're going to link tweets and stuff. It's fascinating to me where maybe a little focus, maybe a little reinvestment. Google has been kind of pushing a few more little software updates to Wear OS. The most recent Mobvoi update on the TicWatch helped clean up and just polish. I mean, I felt like the watch was already outperforming what Wear OS normally felt like. And I just sort of cleaned up a few of the interactions. Like when you go to tap the screen, there's a different interaction. It's a little bit cleaner getting into your lit smartwatch look, and then it seems to pad quicker to get to the low power when you just sort of when you cover the whole screen with your hand. Those little interactions just tweaked and cleaned, and the UI is so much more fluid. So I'll be curious to see. The Apple Watch stands without a lot of direct competition for a computing platform you wear on your wrist. I think for a lot of people, the main competition of a proper smartwatch would be fitness trackers. You know, maybe you have a Fitbit. I just recently reviewed the Amazfit, that GTR 2E, wonderful fitness tracker. I mean, seriously, Marie stole it as soon as I was done with the review. I'm probably not going to get it back. she really digs it. It has kind of replaced her Fitbit, and she's stoked that the battery life is like twice as good as her old Fitbit Charge when her Fitbit Charge started breaking down. So that makes a lot of sense to me. You might just want to cover the basics. You really want to focus on your fitness and health activities. And maybe you kind of care about just getting notifications or alerts to your wrist, but you're not game for a computing experience from your wrist. If Wear OS can kind of close some of that gap with the Apple Watch, it would be nice to have a major player kind of backing that up again. Google investing some interest in it. Google investing some infrastructure in it. Because I got to say, the MobVoi update, the new Snapdragon Wear 4100, this is the smoothest Wear OS has ever worked. It is now worth it to look through the little applets and do something quickly from your wrist rather than pulling out your phone. Like the Fossil watches, when they launched on the Wear 3100, I didn't feel that was true. I felt like if you wanted to do something more than just a quick reply to a text, you know, from your wrist, it was never faster doing it from the watch. It was always faster pulling a phone out of your pocket and doing something that way. Now, some of the little applets, it's pretty quick. Like one of the ones that I love on the Tick Watch, and this is a Tick app, is I'm going to have a hard time showing this off here, reverse angle on the camera, but they have the same kind of hearing monitor that the Apple Watch has, and it blips, and it's going to take an extra second now because I'm trying to do it live. But there, and I've got a little meter that shows how loud the surroundings are around me. And apparently I talk really loud with my voice this close to the watch. That is so much faster than trying to pull up a sound meter on a phone. You know, pulling it out of your pocket, unlocking the phone, going through your app drawer. That's not an app you use a lot. So you've got to kind of go through your app list and then you can pull it up that way. I've actually used this quite a few times. We were driving to the zoo. We wanted to get Lex out of the house for a weekend on really rough roads. And you're like, man, my ears kind of hurt. And a couple little swipes and I could see right away, oh man, it's like 103 decibels in the car right now. We should probably turn down the radio because we're trying to overpower road noise with a louder stereo. Juan is a loud mouth confirmed. That's hilarious. What I want now are better little tie-in applets. Like the one that I love on my Apple Watch is how abbreviated the security, the home security system that we use. You fire it up on the Apple Watch and you get a little menu and you arm your security system and you're done. And it's so much faster than doing that from your phone. I don't know. The little applet doesn't load all of the bells and whistles and all of the extra features and all of the other things. It's really overly simplistic, but we're leaving the house. We get in the car, we go, oh, we should have armed the alarm. Boop, Apple Watch, it's done. And you're done. And now I just want some more stuff like that on Wear OS. The Wear 4100 is a big deal. It is a significant improvement for the local processing power on your wrist. And it doesn't seem to come with too much of a battery hit to get that more fluid UI. Root Knight 5. Either Wear OS is getting a new life or Samsung is looking to cut costs on their smartwatches. from Squishy Man. Smartwatch just for notifications would be nice, and it's been something I've been thinking of getting for a while, but having never owned one, I don't know if I need another piece of technology, even though it's a smartwatch on my wrist. And it's tough to know. It really is tricky to know if that's the kind of thing you're going to dig. I like it because I hate referencing my phone for every little notification that I get. I get way too many notifications. So I am not an average consumer. But I like having an at-a-glance, immediately accessible gatekeeper for the content that comes in. And so something buzzes on my wrist and I take a quick glance down just to see what popped up. And then I get on with my day. And that briefer interaction, I mean, that's actually something that can be well facilitated on a fitness tracker. But I also don't want to see this notification. It's a text from my wife. I need to shoot her just a quick reply. And I don't want to have to bring out my phone or use one of those canned replies like, okay, yes, no. You know, like I want to be able to craft a bit more of a reply without having to pull out a phone. Rich notification support is that step above. That all by itself is the main thing that keeps me on a smartwatch over a fitness tracker for my own personal use. Then the other stuff is just gravy. You know, you get much better messaging support. Like the Messages app on Wear OS is a near mirror for the Messages app on your phone. If you're using the Google Messages app, I should say. The mapping, so much more fluid. When you pull up Google Maps on your wrist, I probably wouldn't launch a map or turn-by-turn navigation from my wrist, but it's working better that I might play with that a bit more. And then also getting your turn-by-turn nav, you know, as updates that kind of pulse through the notification system from your phone to your wrist is just kind of handy. Again, I'm driving, I've got my wrist at eye level, my next turn's coming up and I get a little bit to my wrist. I don't really have to take my eyes off the road as much just to kind of see what the next turn is. Those kinds of quality of life issues are great. But if you don't vibe with them, it's kind of hard to know if you're going to vibe with them before you get one. And then when you get one, you might be like, oh, well, I didn't think, you know, it's not going to be an immediate night and day difference. It's like you kind of have to learn what are the little services and what are the little applets and what are the little things that I really do like. And if you're waiting for the watch to do something for you, it's not. It's like a tablet, right? It's a solution in search of a problem. You need to tell the watch, these are the things I like to do. This is what I want to do. And then it gets way more exciting. If you don't know what those are, the watch is just going to sit there on your wrist and it's not going to do a whole lot. So it's tough. It's really tough to consider. It's really tough to know, is this what I want to throw my money at? Will this make my life better? You kind of can't tell until you play with one. From F. Mooney, I think the death of Wear OS is exaggerated. It has issues, but so do phone operating systems. Average consumers may not know about it, but if you ask what Android version, they'd laugh if you said that they were named after candy. yeah, and there's also, I think it's totally fair. When you strap gadgets to your body, I feel it is fair to question, to consider the aesthetic. I mean, we as techies, we're rational people, and we want to know about the giggle flips and the megapixels, and we make those rational decisions based on merit, not emotions or not the aesthetics, but merit. Nah, I mean, like a watch has to fit. You know, it's got to complement a style, or it's got to contribute to a look. I just got another a PR person from a company that makes Italian, low-cost Italian traditional watches. Just like, you know, some of those watches look really cool. I don't know what I can do for a video on those. I don't know what kind of collaboration you're looking for, but they're really nice-looking watches. Like, I would enjoy wearing a timepiece if I were going out to show that kind of stuff off. I think that's fair. I think my Marie's only criticism of the Amazfit is it's the larger circular version of the Amazfit, and it's a bit big on her wrist. She doesn't wear a bold, big timepiece. She wears little feminine dainty watches, so we might need to look at getting her something else if she's going to long-term a different kind of fitness tracker. I feel like that's another thing where if we've got Wear OS in the marketplace beyond just Fossil, we'll have more opportunities, more competition, better selection for people to land on something that might be a better complement to their own personal style. You know, it's interesting, you know, like, there's a certain kind of consumer who's going to look at an Apple Watch and go, well, yeah, that's the correct choice. And now my style is going to be morphed to fit the Apple aesthetic. And there are going to be other people who are like, nah, I like my old school Skagen. Do you have a watch that looks like that? No? Okay, well, I'll pass. Thanks. So it's just interesting. A sort of confluence, the congregation of tech and features and functionality versus aesthetic and fashion. We're still super early, just the beginnings of kind of exploring what we can do with it. And Dave Burns, fashion is not rational, but I think people want to look good. I could care less, but at this point, Liz has explained to me that I'm not unfashionable. I'm just cheap. Chatty Boy, one, I would like a review on the Wise Watch from you when it launches. That's another one. I'm very interested in seeing what they do. Again, I kind of slow played wearables for a while. After leaving Pocket Now, I got some, not spiky, but like, we're not going to be working with you kinds of emails from the Fossil Group. Like, they were not interested in me covering their products. I was trying to do a wearable segment on Fox LA, which a morning TV news program in Los Angeles garners more audience than most states in the United States. LA is a huge market. And I reached out to Fossil and said, hey, I'd love to cover in the segment that we're doing on fitness trackers and smartwatches. I'd love for Fossil to be represented and to showcase what more a smartwatch can do over a fitness tracker. And I'm looking at doing a follow-up, a companion piece to this at Newegg for Newegg Now. That's right at the peak when we were doing those really high quality polished live broadcasts. And they were like, I mean, I shouldn't quote them too directly because it's kind of burned into my memory, but basically got a reply like, no, we're not interested. You're like, okay, cool. I'll never talk to you ever again. Thanks. Bye. Instead, like, used Samsung, Apple. I did show off a Tick Watch. I believe it was one of the lower cost Tick Watches for that segment. But it was like, man, it's like, you guys don't want to talk about any of this. All right, cool. I can't help you then. So it was very disappointing because I had a pretty good relationship with what was the Misfit label. I had done some work covering wearables at Pocket Now, and they seemed super like into the idea of fitness tracker and coverage. And they're a part of the Fossil Group. They're one of the brands that's owned by Fossil. Reaching out as a solo dude, mass market Los Angeles, mass market Newegg, and my own personal channel. Not good enough. Not interested in working with you. And Heike, the Skagen watches are gorgeous. I still have my Skagen hybrid. I love that thing. I mean, obviously these days I'm not leaving the house at all. When I start traveling again, I flippin' love that hybrid smartwatch. Just the Skagen look in general is just so clean. I like what that looks like. I'm hoping that we'll see sort of a follow-up on this new Wear 4100 for their active screen timepieces, but the hybrid, the just analog screen, that's going to be in my collection until I can't get a new battery for it. It's just gorgeous. Aditya, Juan wears only a OnePlus watch on his only Juans. I feel Aditya missed an opportunity to make a OnePlus watch joke at my expense. I'm just saying, if you're going to tag me with Juan, I feel like you missed a step there. Simon says, no, Skagen featuring some gadget guy watches now available. So the reason why I kind of wanted to front load OnePlus, OnePlus is trying to broaden their consumer catalog, more phones, more headphones, more audio accessories, wireless chargers, and an entire kind of ecosystem of accessories and gadgets. And I think a watch fits into that lineup pretty well now. I'll be interested to see if they bring anything unique to the smartwatch experience, where I feel like Tick Watch, Mobvoi has become my favorite because they've added on top. I got a little burnt out on Fossil because they all kind of felt the same. Cookie cutter, just the bare minimum of what a Wear OS watch could do. And there wasn't any in their lineup that I felt like contributed something unique. With TicWatch, it's the dual display. It helps you get like 3 days of runtime of actual use and battery life. You know, like I love not having to charge my watch every day. And then also they still play with custom UI. The whole four swipe interaction that we have on a lot of different wearables now comes from Mobvoi. They were the first to properly give us that cross pattern swipe navigation on the original TicWatch. You pull out the original TicWatch back when Android Wear was nothing but those Google cards, and it looks like a watch of today. It still functions like a watch of today. The original TicWatch is still in my lineup. Like, I'll bring it out and charge it up and use it for a couple days. It's still current. It's that good. And it was all because they were ahead of the curve on software. So when you see some of like the little tweaks to like how the app drawer scrolls up on a TicWatch, it's like, yeah, I kind of like that better than just regular Android Wear. I think I'm going to keep it. It's good. Oh, and hey, we've got Aiden Kosick is raiding. Raiding with a party of one, but that's still a raid. I'm digging it. Bring some raid energy. I always greatly appreciate folks branching out, finding some other folks to bring along to the party. It's appreciated. Thank you so much. The last thing I want to highlight here, because we've been talking about smartwatches and stuff, I kind of meant to focus a little bit more in on the rumors for OnePlus, but this is also coming at the same time. Like I said, Samsung is probably going to be going to Wear OS. Mobvoi, ahead of the game. I'm telling you, you can wait for Samsung to catch up and offer similar hardware, or you could be on a TicWatch right now. And it's pretty good. It's pretty nice. I've been digging it. One of the things we've got to keep an eye out on, creating custom tiles on Wear OS by Google with Jetpack Tiles Library. This is coming from the Android Developers blog. Just another little kernel that Google is putting a bit more oomph behind developer outreach. So one of the more recent updates to Wear OS added these lateral swipes so that you could add quick shortcut tiles. And again, a lot of fitness trackers borrow this kind of UI navigation. But it looks like Google is opening up the developer resources kit so more app developers can build tiles for Wear OS. Now, this is coming after support for the original applet protocol in Android Wear has been almost completely severed and devalued. So older Android Wear watches are going to have a much harder time grabbing little applets or even just uninstalling stuff. I mean, just that relationship between watch applet and main phone app has been kind of cut. I think this is a step in the right direction to kind of fulfill some of that streamlined developer process for getting software and relevant software on a smartwatch. It's to help get developers started. And so they've got code in here just to say, hey, if you want to get started making a little tile for an Android Wear and a Wear OS smartwatch, here's how you can jump in and start making some of this stuff. And then this is going to be an abbreviated library of ways that you can very quickly add functionality to your applet. And that's kind of a big deal. Again, like I was saying, if my security system could add a Wear OS applet, I'd probably never use the app on my phone ever again. I want better tie-in with some of my security cameras where I can maybe, you know, highlight, I get a notification that there's been motion and I can just tap directly on my watch and get like a screenshot pop up. They've already improved things like the Bluetooth tethering for the camera app. I can now fire up the camera app from my phone directly from my wrist and have like remote shutter and controls. Like Samsung did it first, but it's here on Android. I keep saying on Android Wear. It's here on Wear OS also. And anything that we can do to kind of flesh out the additional features for health and heart rate tracking. Blood oxygen is on the Tick Watch. I'd love to see more watches come with ECG, but it's, and again, I'm trying not to get my hopes up. I'm trying not to let my expectations get out of control, but it's getting kind of fun again. Like, smartwatches are hopefully gonna get a shot in the arm here. Like, is it gonna be cool? I don't know. Some competition in the space would be kind of nice. And especially, you know, I've said this before, I want Wear OS to be more than just watches. Like, I want a Wear OS interface up at eye level on some smart glasses. I want Wear OS to communicate with other sensors and trackers and, you know, pedometers in my shoes and compression gear that maybe I wear around my chest. Like, I want this to become more of an ecosystem and not just one neglected piece of software that runs a watch. So I'm hoping. I'm trying not to get my hopes up too high. I'm trying not to get my expectations up too high, but oh, there's some glimmers here. There's some little clues that could be really neat. Just open. Gary the Fireman. Is it true that the password for your home security system is 12345? No, but that is the code I use on my luggage. So, you know, only a jerk would use that password for their home security system. I just got to text Marie real quick, completely unrelated, nothing to do with what's going on here. All right. Closing this show down, wrapping this show up. Folks, thanks so much for jumping in. Like I said, this was a heavy housekeeping week, and I still have quite a bit of stuff that's going to be popping up on all of the channels. There's going to be another reviews.org video. I think there's still going to, I don't think it's going to be this next week. It might be the following week, but we're talking with Newegg about doing another live stream on some cool PC building, some content that's going to be coming out there. Fingers crossed that this big major project I'm working on, I can start talking about more. And then reviews, follow-ups, the camera deep dive for the Galaxy S21 is almost done. I'm going to be doing a camera deep dive on the Nord N10 following. So just some follow-up camera conversations. I've been a little behind getting those started here in 2021. Catching this stuff up, knocking this stuff out, and I think it's going to be good. I've been having a lot of fun. And especially like playing with audio kit again, microphones and headphones and interfaces and Bluetooth and cables. And it's just been real good. So closing the show out, Paul dropping some gift subs here for the Sentinel, Damn It, Adrian, Burkmaid, Aiden, JB Fournay, Hill Gigas, Roberto Hunts, Big X, Daddy X, Maddox X, 1981 X, Tech Homie, and Jaeger's Twitch. Thank you, Paul, and everyone who was contributing. Gary the Fireman, Alt Dad. I know El Jefe re-upped his own personal sub. We hit that hype train hard at the beginning of this podcast. Thank you so much. That's huge. And again, for everyone, even if you're not gifting subs or subbing yourself, it's just joining a conversation, joining discussions, and helping to spread the good word on some good tech. Means the world to me, and I greatly appreciate the participation, the support, and all the sharing for all the various things that I'm making, and then all the things that our community is trying to represent. So folks, I want you to have an amazing week with your technology. I want you to do awesome with your tech. I want you to be awesome with your tech, and I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SDGQA podcast channel. Be safe. It's crazy out there. We're getting so close to figuring out what the new normal for our lives is going to be. Now's not the time to make a dumb mistake. Keep your heads down. Stay safe. Be well. I'll catch you back here next week. I love you all. Take care.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now,
the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.